Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down, it's coming nearer to this old town, rich and poor.
Welcome to The Cross in the Desert. We're speaking hope and freedom to Iran on this Monday morning, October 6th, and I hope that everyone will have a fantastic week. Had a great weekend. I wanted to tell you a little bit about my weekend. Celebrated my 13th wedding anniversary with my dear wife, Becky, and we had a nice time together. Went to a place called Sugar Creek Winery, beautiful countryside. Lots of great times together there. Just want to let you know that there is a life outside of Blog Talk Radio, writing books, doing blogs, the things that I do, and it was wonderful to spend it there with my wife. Well, this is a difficult day for all of us who are surrounding Rahana Jabari with our love and prayers, with our tweeting, with our speaking out, with our activism. According to the Iranian regime, according to her mother, Sholeh Pakhrivan, the imminency of this execution is the morning of October 8th, Iranian time. And so what that means for us as activists, we have a lot of work to do. Yesterday was a pivotal day for Rahana. It was International Rahana Day. Tweeting all afternoon. I was at work, but I still found some time to get some tweets in and get the message out. It was a long work day for me at the bookstore, renovating the entire bookstore. We had a really, really busy day. But many, many thousands of people tweeted in behalf of Rahana. They're going to do the same today. I believe the time is different. It's according to Greenwich time. Yesterday it was 6:30. Greenwich time, 6:30 in the evening, which meant it's about 12 my time, where I live here in St. Louis. Today, I believe it's a different time, but nonetheless, save Rahana Jabari, hashtag save Rahana Jabari. We're doing that. We're speaking out. We're doing everything we can to put pressure on this regime to stop this unjust execution of this very innocent girl who has had her life on the line. Twice her execution has been postponed. Can you imagine the horror and the feelings that go through her mind waiting to die? Well, if we have anything to say about it, as human rights activists, we're going to say to Iran, release Rahana. She's innocent. She is not guilty. And she defended herself against a rapist. There was much, much disinformation on this kangaroo trial. Much information was not allowed in, and this needs to be stopped. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to spend some time in this first half hour talking about Rahana. At the 10 o'clock hour, I'm going to have a special guest. Her name is Saba. She's from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, UMSL here. And we're going to talk about women in Islam, the issues. She is a Muslim. She's British-American, and we're going to talk about some of the issues of women in Islam, a very insightful interview coming up at the 10 o'clock hour. Later on, I want to also address Christianity. How does Christianity treat women? The subject is going to be Jesus and women. My guest is going to be Dr. Ben Witherington from a very scholarly viewpoint, he's going to talk about the impact of Christianity upon women. We're going to talk about that issue later on. Lots to do today. But what I want to begin with is this very insightful, emotional interview that Lisa Deftari, a contributor to Fox News, had with Sholeh Parkravan, that is Rahana's mother, just a few days ago. It's about a 7.5-minute interview. There is an interpreter for Sholeh, but it is such a powerful interview. I want you to hear it right now on the cross in the desert.
I'm Lisa Deftari for FoxNews.com. 26-year-old Rehana Jabari was sentenced to death in Iran for killing a man who tried to rape her. Her execution was scheduled for Tuesday, but it was postponed at the last minute. Today I'm joined via Skype by her mother, Sholeh Parkravan. Welcome to you, Sholeh. Thank you for joining us. You got such a chilling phone call from your daughter yesterday, who told you that she was going to be killed, that it was her last phone call. Here's what she said to you, her last phone call from prison. "Goodbye, dear mom. All of my pains will finish early tomorrow morning. I'm sorry I cannot lessen your pain. Be patient. We believe in life after death. I'll see you in the next world, and I will never leave you again, because being separated from you is the most difficult thing to do in the world." Must have been the most difficult phone call you've ever received. What were your thoughts?
من موقعی که زنگ زد چون اصلا توقع نداشتم.
When she called, I didn't expect to get this news. Just the day before, we had a visit, and it was such a nice visit. It was happy and made us hopeful. So the next day when she called, it was like a normal daily call. Just imagine, I was expecting her to just say, "Hi, how are you?" or ask me routine things. Sometimes I read her poetry or play a song for her, but she sounded so distraught. And she said, "Mom, they are calling me in for questioning." I kept Rehana on the line on my cell, and I dialed our attorney and asked her if they were going to carry out the sentence. And she said no. So I said to Rehana, "Don't worry. When my daughter went, that's when they handcuffed her and said they would execute her." In reality, they didn't want her to have any contact with her family, and they didn't want her cellmates to even see. She hadn't even said goodbye to them. I told her, "Rehana, this is impossible. This is illegal. They can't do this. Your case is up for reevaluation. None of this makes sense." Rehana replied, "My dearest mother, you can rationalize this however you'd like, but they are taking me to kill me. I don't know what else to say. How can I describe to you how my heart is being ripped into shreds?" She said, "Mom, I just called to tell you goodbye. My arms and legs were trembling, and I told Rehana, "Please don't be scared. There must be a mistake. This is all impossible." She said, "Okay, Mom, but I will say my goodbyes anyway." My voice was shaking. I knew she was so scared. Just imagine you wake up one day and they tell you, "We will execute you tomorrow."
Now you've heard that the execution has been postponed. What have you been told?
Last night we were protesting in front of the prison. They told us they took Rehana away, but because we had been at the main entrance of the prison, we didn't see any cars leave the prison. We thought they were lying and that they only wanted to get rid of us protesters from in front of the prison. Imagine from about 9 p.m., from about 2:30 a.m., we didn't know what had happened to her. We were just screaming, "Rehana, do you hear us?"
What were you thinking at that time?
I thought Rehana could feel me in her heart the way I was feeling for her. For her to know I am right next to her, right alongside her, I am in excruciating pain. We were all waiting outside and shouting together, Rehana, we love you. Rehana, hear our voices. Rehana, don't be sad.
What's your message to the world? What can people do to help your daughter?
The only thing I want in this universe is for Rehana to be released. I have done everything that I can think of. I am a mother. No mother can accept the death of her child. But to tell a mother, in 10 hours your child won't be here, there is no greater pain in the world.
To the rest of the world looking at this case, it looks like a case of self-defense. Why doesn't the government of Iran see it that way?
I don't know. I just speak for myself. The only way to get out of this is to get a pardon from his family. I prefer not to get into the details of the case because as a mother, the last thing I want is to jeopardize my daughter's life for something I may say. That's my predicament right now. Errors in my daughter's case, in the judicial system, and how the case has been decided, and how they took her in, how they got her to confess. There may be a lot of errors.
As you shed these tears and your daughter is sitting in prison, Iran's President Rouhani is in New York attending the United Nations General Assembly, along with other leaders from all over the world, and he's also trying to strike a deal to normalize relations with the West. What would be your message to the Western leaders who are sitting at the negotiating table with your president?
What goes on around the world, the nuclear talks, I can't think of any of these things right now. The only thing I want from God, from people around the world, in any way, in any form, is I just want to bring Rehana back home. I wish they would come tie a rope around my neck to kill me instead, but to allow Rehana to come back home.
And you made a gift for your daughter to give to her, hopefully when she's released. Show us that gift.
This scarf, this is a cage, and door is open, and there's a dove coming out of it. This dove is my Rehana. And all throughout the scarf, there are other doves. It's as though all the prisoners in all the world will be released. From the bottom of my heart, I want it so that no mother has to go through what I'm going through now. I just hope that as soon as possible, my Rehana can come back to me, just like this dove.
We are thinking of you, and we hope the best for your daughter. Thank you for your time.
That's Lisa Daftari, Fox News contributor, interviewing Rehana's mother, Sholi Pakhravan. Some amazing things that this very courageous lady said, that she would rather have the rope tied around her neck so that Rehana would not have to suffer and die. And you can only imagine the depth of love of a mother for her child. And the idea of this scarf, if God willing, Rehana is somehow exonerated and released, she has a picture of a dove flying out from a cage on a scarf. I think anyone that is a mother, anyone that is a parent, can empathize with the incredible pain and suffering of Sholi. To think that what she said, what would you think if you heard that your daughter would no longer be with you in 10 hours? She said the pain, you can't imagine the pain. Well, Sholi, our thoughts and prayers are with you and Rehana. We will never give up. We will fight. We will not give up on this. We are going to do everything we can as activists to say no to this execution, to put pressure on the regime. The truth must be made known. And this is an innocent girl who defended herself against a vicious rapist who tried to sexually assault her after deceiving her with a project of redesigning his office. And we are going to fight for Rouhana. That's what we do here, speaking hope and freedom to Iran on the cross in the desert. Well, I want to also play this short clip of Mr. James Bazan from the Canadian House of Commons speaking out for Rouhana Jabari right here on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Mr. Speaker, I'm again advocating for Iranian prisoner Ms. Rouhani Jabari. Ms. Jabari continues to be at risk of imminent execution for defending herself and killing her attacker who was attempting to rape her. She is only 26 years old and was recently transferred from Tehran's Evin prison to be executed and was told to say her goodbyes to her family. In April, a court postponed Jabari's execution in the face of heavy international criticism, including an international petition with nearly 200,000 signatures. This grim news that the execution will soon be carried out came as Iranian President Hassani Rouhani was speaking in New York at the United Nations, trying to put a moderate face on the regime. Instead of increasing their number of executions, Rouhani's government should reform their judicial system to meet international law and respect jurisprudence. I urge the Iranian regime to respect Mrs. Jabari's rights. Her imprisonment and treatment are inhumane and unacceptable. I once again call on President Rouhani to exercise clemency, stay her execution, and suspend her sentence.
Thank you, Mr. James Bazan from Canada's House of Commons, for standing up for Rouhana Jabari. Canada does an incredible amount of support in standing up and speaking out for Iranians. I really applaud Canada for their graciousness, for their kindness in what they do. I have a good friend named Shadi Pave who writes for a particular, and I'm thinking of it, the Gatestone. I'm sorry, Shadi. My mind just slipped of me. And she writes some incredible articles. She's also an incredible friend. I dedicated my new book, Chasing After Rainbows, to my good friend Shadi Pave as a human rights activist living in Canada. Just recently on the Gatestone, she had a very insightful article about what's happening in Iran. Iran's political prisoner cleansing is the name of the article. And she's dealing with Rouhana Jabari and several others that are on death row or are missing. And I want you to hear this article. I'm going to read it word for word because it's that good. And I want you to get the understanding and the insight of what's going on here. Prison authorities ordered the crowd to leave and assured Jabari's family that she was not to be hanged, a statement the authorities commonly make before an execution so it can be carried out quietly without incident. Meanwhile, Ayatollah Bojaderi has been taken from his prison cell in Evin to be executed and is being held incommunicado at an undisclosed location. Also missing is dissident blogger Mohammad Reza Pour Shajari and prominent student activist Arash Sadegi, both presumed to have been rearrested according to friends and family. The mainstream media and so-called human rights groups have, as usual, remained silent. The regime tells the media that information about missing prisoners is inaccurate in order to prevent publication of the news. The Iranian killing machine seems to be counting on the reluctance of the U.S. to intervene in any serious way in order to run its nuclear weapons programs to completion. Iran continues to hide behind the world's focus on ISIS to accelerate political arrests, executions, prison cleansing, and above all, its program to achieve nuclear capability. Iran seems to be counting on the reluctance of the United States to intervene in any serious way in order to run its nuclear weapons program to completion. Most recently, according to the International Committee Against Execution, Rouhana Jabari, who was transferred to Rajeh Shahar prison to be hanged on Monday, September 29th, has been returned to her cell in Shahar Rai prison. Her execution was halted, only to be rescheduled for October 8th. On September 29th, Jabari was seized by prison guards during her shower, forced to dress, and told that she would be hanged in the morning. After the prison staff allowed her to make one last phone call, her mother, as we just heard, she was transferred to Rajeh prison and placed in solitary confinement to await execution at dawn. Upon her daughter's transfer, Jabari's mother, Sholeh Pakravan, rushed to the prison with her husband, two daughters, and a few friends. In front of the prison, a crowd grew quickly to protest Jabari's execution. Prison authorities ordered the crowd to leave and assured Jabari's family that she was not to be hanged, a statement the authorities commonly make before an execution so it can be carried out quietly without incident. Sholeh Pakravan refused to leave the premises until her daughter was transferred unharmed back to her original cell in Shahar Rey Prison. I want you to notice that Shadi fills in a few details. I didn't know how that she was apprehended when she was taking a shower, some of the things that are going on. And in this article, point is that Iran loves to deceive us, to get our attention on ISIS, to keep us on the nuclear program while it carries out its horrific cleansing machine. And I think that they're counting on some of the media and some of the human rights people to be silent while this goes on. And we need to be vigilant to fill the airwaves and to challenge the regime and to bombard them and to put pressure on them. And so I really appreciate Shadi and the information on what Iran is trying to do behind the scenes as it continues to sell its bill of goods about the nuclear program. And as you heard in these interviews, Rouhani coming on the table, going to the United Nations, charming everyone with his smile, but behind him, executions continue. They have tripled since he became president in August of 2013. Well, speaking of executions, prisoner cleansing, and the things that are happening, I want to bring us now to the story I've been following. It's on Ganache Gabami, a young lady who was arrested for attending a men's volleyball game back in June, and she is in Evin prison. I want you to hear this brief report on Ganache Gabami from her brother right now on the cross in the desert.
3 months ago, this London law graduate had a great deal to look forward to. But for the last 87 days, she's been held in Tehran's notorious Evin prison, nearly half of that in solitary confinement. Gonchev Gabami was apparently taunted by prison officers who said she wouldn't get out alive. Her crime? Watching volleyball. Her family are desperate.
She's a very energetic, passionate 25-year-old woman. Her plan was to visit family and do some volunteering with street kids. And she was actually working, volunteering with street kids and teaching them how to read and write was, I think, the highlight of her stay at that point in Tehran.
That was the joy of being half British, half Iranian. Gonchev flitted between her home in West London and her parents' place in Iran. All that changed on June the 20th. With thousands of others, she went to watch the national team play at the Azadi Stadium. The imam says his sister thought a ban on women going to see men's volleyball had been lifted. She was wrong. Gonchev was arrested and questioned for 4 hours. Days later, when she returned to a police station to collect her things, she was arrested again and thrown in jail.
The authorities, they took my dad and her home, and they confiscated her books, her phone, iPad, two or three laptops, and they took her, and we didn't hear from her for the next 11 days. And after 11 days, she made a phone call, and we found out that she was being kept at Evin prison. My parents were devastated. My mom, she's restless all the time. And my dad, I mean, he has aged like 10 years in the past 3 months.
This is Gonchev in June last year on Iranian election day. Her finger inked like that of the man she wanted to become president, Hassan Rouhani. Now her family are hoping they can end her nightmare, and Britain too. Do you fear that British diplomats might hesitate because of the importance of Iran's role in the region?
I don't think my sister's case has anything to do with politics, and I think it's more of a human story, and all we want is to bring her back home.
And so you might think it ideal that Rouhani and David Cameron should meet today. But although the Prime Minister expressed concern about Gonchev's case, her family fear the British won't want to be too critical. The West is wooing Iran right now. They have a common enemy, so-called Islamic State.
I think they wouldn't arrest and keep her in that prison for 85 days and almost 41 days in solitary confinement purely for attending a volleyball match.
This week, finally, she was charged with propaganda against the state. Her brother travelled to New York in the hope of meeting President Rouhani. Thus far, he has been elusive.
That is Iman Ganache's brother speaking frankly about the situation. Now, I know a lot of you may say, well, this young university student, she's doing a good thing. She's going out in the streets helping street people learn the English language. She is a law student at London, and she thought it was fine to go to this volleyball game because somehow she imagined that the ban had been lifted. But in the report, she talked about voting for Rouhani last year. So many of you may think, well, isn't she getting what she deserved? Well, I don't agree with her voting for Rouhani, but let's go beyond that. She is someone that's in prison. She is someone that is desperate, and she was simply attending a volleyball match, and this was an egregious error on her part because she thought there was the lifting of the ban. And so we should continue to speak out for her no matter who she voted for. Well, let me try to explain this to you. Many of my Iranian friends, in their own way, said that they would boycott this election. And there are those of my friends who voted for Rouhani because they're desperate, not because they're being naive so much as they are desperate. And perhaps Ganache felt the same way because Rouhani is very deceptive and charming. He's billed as a moderate. So many of my own friends have stooped to this level and said, you know what, I'm desperate. I live here in Iran. And so instead of being overly critical, we need to put ourselves in their place. This is where they live. And they are trying their best to survive under very harsh government situations. And some of them feeling that, okay, he's different than Ahmadinejad. He's not as explosive. Maybe he can do us some good. Well, of course, that's not true. He's deceptive. Things have worsened. Rouhani has not kept his promises. But again, these are my friends that live there. And although I totally disagree with who they voted for, they are my friends, and I will continue to love them, support them, and pray for them. And the same needs to be said of Ganache. She has recently went on a hunger strike, and we need to support her, to speak out for her, to pray for her, that she too can be released, because the conditions in Evin prison are just unbelievable. And when I read my book from my best friends, Miriam and Marzia, Captive in Iran, and learned about how the condition in Evin prison is, this is a place that none of us on the planet would ever want to ever end up in. And so my heart goes out to Ganache. And so I pray for her. I speak out for her just like I will do for anyone that is in that horrible place suffering. Now, she's undergoing a hunger strike. Her mother says she's going to do the same thing, too, until her daughter is released. And about, I think, 300 Iranian human rights and civil rights activists wrote an open letter to President Hassan Rouhani and reminded him of Ms. Ghavami's unbearable conditions and, quote, asked him to act in accordance with your electioneering pledge of defending the rights of Iranian citizens, which secured your win. So they're reminding him of his pledge. And a couple of programs ago, I outlined the many promises that Rouhani has failed to comply with. In fact, more Facebook people are in prison now simply for disagreeing with the government. One of the promises Rouhani made was more freedom on the internet, more women's rights freedom, more freedom for political prisoners, all of these unfulfilled promises. And this group is saying in this letter addressed to him, look, you're not keeping your promise, and even to those that voted for you. So I really applaud these Iranian human rights activists for taking the cause right to the president and reminding him of the many, many promises he made that have gone unfulfilled. Now, a lot of my friends will say, well, the supreme leader has the last word, and that's true. But again, this is typical of all politicians that will pledge and promise anything simply to get your vote. So continue to pray, to speak out, and petition for Ghana J. Gavami's freedom as she lingers in solitary confinement on a hunger strike in Evin prison. Right now, joining me on the cross in the desert is a good friend. Her name is Saba. She is a student at UMSL, that is the University of Missouri, St. Louis, very close to where I live. And she's been on my program before talking about her screening of the film Honor Diaries. And I spoke with Saba over the weekend, and we've decided to talk about the issues of women in Islam. And so I want to welcome you, Saba, this morning to the Cross in the Desert. Good morning. How are you?
Morning. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Saba, I don't know if you had a chance to listen. I've been talking the first half an hour about Rahana and about the suffering she's going through, and they have rescheduled the execution for this Wednesday. And many of us just yesterday had a tweet storm in behalf of Rahana, and I know you're following this very closely too.
Yes, that's right.
It's a very serious situation. And also I was talking about Ghana Che, the young lady that was arrested and put in prison for attending a men's volleyball match. These issues with women and the way they are treated and the many, many ways that they are oppressed, these are issues near and dear to your heart as well. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Now, I wanted to talk to you this morning on the issue of women in Islam. You are also a Muslim, and you have spent a lot of your time speaking out for the issue of women in Islam. Tell us a little bit about your background as a human rights activist and how you came to this passion of speaking out.
Okay, that's a very long story. I've kind of been doing this since I was a teenager, so it's been a very long time. And I actually came about it when I was 12 years old, and I first heard about the first honor killing. It was about a Muslim girl who got impregnated by her British boyfriend, and her mother strangled her to death while her younger brother tied her hands behind her back. And, you know, her mother was kind of like kneeling on her chest while strangling her. And from that moment, I was like totally shocked. I'm like, what is going on? This isn't Islam. This isn't my religion. My religion is a religion of peace. And then I started looking into it, and just like the more I looked into it, the more similar crimes kind of popped up. And in 2004, the elder brother of one of my good friends was actually a victim of an honor killing. So that hit really close to home. And I'm like, I have to do something. Like before, I was researching and talking about it, but then when my friend's elder brother was a victim, I was like, okay, this isn't just a woman's issue. This thing, this, mm-hmm. I don't know, virus or whatever you want to call it, it's affecting everyone. So it's just like that really motivated me to like, okay, enough with the research. I got to get out and do something.
So, now, as you've been researching this, I was going to ask, as you've been researching this and you recently had a screening for the film Honor Diaries, which deals with one of the issues you're researching, and that is honor killings, you've had a lot of criticism from your own Muslim friends about this.
Yes. Friends, family, like the whole Muslim community has just been, it's been very hectic, which is why I probably sound really down right now, because over the past couple of days, since the screening, I have had nothing but backlash. So I'm kind of going to that stage where I'm really confused. Like, I'm kind of like a pendulum. I'm swinging back and forth. No, you know, maybe they're right. No, I can't stop what I'm doing. So, I mean, I've even been told that I'm committing a sin bringing this forward, like telling non-Muslims what's happening. Like, wait, how is this a sin? I'm trying to promote awareness. I'm trying to stop this from happening. And I don't know, it's just really hectic.
Well, I can tell you, Saba, I'm friends with Zainab from the film Honor Diaries, and I know how committed she is to bringing awareness, and from Raquel Saraswati. And they have all received the same criticism as you. They understand the pain and the fear that you're going through. And all of these women in honor diaries, I'm sure, took a great risk as Muslims standing up. But nonetheless, they made this film, and they are making this awareness. And what you're doing, Saba, is not only a very courageous thing, but a very important thing in your education. You are taking an objective look at what's happening in your religion. And you could close your eyes and silence your voice and not say anything, but you're saying, no, I need to speak out about what's happening in my religion and tell them, no, this is not what my religion does. These are extremists. You're going out on a limb, and you're being very courageous. So I applaud you for that. We support you here at the Cross in the Desert. And we will stand behind you because you, like many other women, are saying, enough is enough. I'm tired. I'm not going to keep silent. So you're continuing on your fight. You're trying to bring awareness. So you did the honor diary screening, and you're going to continue on, aren't you?
Yes, I actually started doing, like, promoting social awareness when I first moved to America when I was 19, and I started with presentations, and then I heard about Saving Faith that came out, and I showed that on campus, a lot of opposition then. And then I kind of, like, I guess you could say I went underground because I was receiving death threats, and then I came back with honor diaries, because when I heard about honor diaries, I was like, yes, finally, there's a group of women who are doing exactly what I want to do. Because when I wanted to make a movie, when I wanted people to kind of like join forces with me, no one would stand up with me. They're like, no, I don't want to get killed. No, you know, I don't want to end up like you. So I was like, oh, okay. And I didn't know what to do because I felt really alone. I felt like, am I crazy? Am I the only one doing this? It just really set me back.
Yes, and you notice that there are courageous women out there, and it's good to have friends, other Muslims that join with you in the fight. Now, I want to talk to you about the issue of women in Islam. And we talked about this on our Twitter messaging back and forth, that you want to bring awareness and education, and you want to fight some of the stereotypes that the media is always talking about. Now, you've had some questions from your friends there at university. What are the common questions you get? What are the common misconceptions or the stereotype about women in Islam that we can learn about?
The most common is about the Muslim dress, how women should be allowed to dress. I mean, there's no, like, restriction. The only restriction is cover your bosom, be modest. And, like, I wear T-shirt and jeans to school, and people have problem with that. Like, the Muslim community, they're like, oh, you're showing too much. I'm like, I'm just wearing T-shirt and jeans. So I get judged for that. They call me the devil. They call me an infidel. They say I'm too Americanized. I'm like, okay, if being Americanized is a sin, then why are you here? You know, I mean, these are like American Muslims.
Well,
I mean, it's
that's
very, very difficult.
Yes, that's such a shame, Saba. And you know well, as well what I do here. I talk a lot about Iranian women. In Iran, the hijab is mandatory. The morality police will arrest you, will fine you, will lash you if you're showing too much skin, wearing excessive makeup, or not wearing the hijab properly. Your point is this. As a real Muslim, we should have a choice. In fact, there are many Muslims all over the world, Muslim women who don't wear the hijab but are still committed, faithful Muslims. And so I think if I'm seeing what you're saying that we have a choice. This is not mandatory. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. And there's a time and place for everything. Like, I don't wear hijab, but I'm Muslim. When I'm at home, I pray, but I don't pray when I'm at college because, like I said, there's a time and place for everything. So, and like the people who force it upon others, that's wrong because Islam says there's no compulsion in religion. So how can they call themselves Muslims when they're forcing people to do this? I have seen Muslims at the UMSL campus forcing Americans to convert. Are you Muslim? No, why not? And then hand them the Quran. You should become Muslim. Or they're like, repeat after me, you know? And they're telling them to say the Shahada. Once you say the Shahada, you're Muslim. But I believe that you are not Muslim until it's in your heart that you're Muslim. Your beliefs have become Islamic. You can't just tell someone to recite a verse from the Quran and that's it, magic, you're Muslim. But these people, they believe that once you've said it, there's no turning back. You are now a Muslim. And they are also the same people who believe that Islam is the one and only true religion. Whereas my thinking, I'm a bit more open-minded. I'm like, every religion is like, they have, everyone has their own path to the same destination, God. It's the same God, but we just refer to him by different names. God, Allah, you know, I don't know about the others, but because I went to a Church of England school, so I'm more familiar with Christianity and Islam.
I think a lot of us that watch what's happening in the Middle East, we look on the internet, we see what's happening with ISIS, we see just how these quote-unquote people who call themselves Muslim, they want to take over the world. They want to force women to marry them, young women to marry them. There's forced marriages. There's the beheading of those that aren't Muslim, that don't agree with them. And so as people watch the news and watch ISIS, and there is the common conception that this is true of all Muslims, that all Muslims are terrorists, that all Muslims want to dominate, that all Muslims want to take over the world. What say you about that?
Okay, I would say that ISIS, first of all, are not Muslims. They are monsters. And
yes.
I never think ill of anyone, but because of what they're doing, I wish that the ground would just open up and just take them down to the lowest levels of hell. Because they are not Muslims, and I don't know what their aim is, but fear, spreading Islam through fear is not the way to spread Islam. Islam, if you want to convert to Islam, that's a choice. You cannot force anyone to convert. And it goes for any religion. So, and like, they say that they're Muslim, but the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself said, treat women and children as if they are petals of a flower. They are not treating women and children like that. So how can they call themselves Muslim?
This is a good point. Again, I like what you're saying because I'm talking to you. I'm asking you. I'm not reading it in a book. I'm not watching it on a TV program or looking at it on a special report. I'm talking to someone that's a Muslim that should know the difference. And so it must be very frustrating for you when you see many people assuming that this is true Islam, and you're saying, absolutely not. I wish the ground would swallow them up, and I hear what you're saying. It's got to be frustrating, though, when you interact with those that are non-Muslims to have to deal with the stereotypes. I know as a Christian, I have to do the same thing, too. There are many, many people that say this group, you know, they call themselves the Christians, and I try to correct them saying, no, they're not followers of Jesus if they're behaving that way, if they're using force, if they're using violence. That's they can call themselves Christians. But that doesn't mean they are. So I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a very difficult thing to have to handle the stereotypes, isn't it?
Yeah, and to be honest, like, this sounds really bad being a Muslim myself, but because of what's happening and because of so many conservative Muslims following the same ideals as ISIS, I avoid Muslims myself. Like, most of my 99% of my friends are all non-Muslims because I just don't want to deal with the conservative people. Because they're forcing me to be who I'm not and saying I'm committing a sin by promoting women's rights or showing movies that show what is happening in the name of Islam when I'm just trying to break the stereotype and tell people this is not Islam. I'm like, okay, if you're trying to hide something, then you're doing something wrong. I'm not hiding anything. Like, even these interviews, I don't come prepared. I just call in and you're just giving, you know, asking me questions and I'm just answering just like off the top of my head, no preparation, no nothing, because I don't need preparation.
I like the way you're being open-minded and honest, and yes, you're right. We don't sit down and discuss question after question, and I like your answers because they come from your heart, and you're saying it the way you feel, and you're trying to be authentic and say, look, if you really want to know Islam, don't watch the media, don't watch ISIS, don't watch what's going on. Talk to me. I can tell you. I have nothing to hide, and I appreciate that. You know, Saba, I wrote a book 3 years ago called Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. It's about seeing through the eyes of Muslims that are constantly harassed and accused of being terrorists. And it's the story of two women, Ariel and Esther. One a Muslim, one a Christian, and the book talks about their friendship, their unconditional love for one another. And this is my goal, Saba, that we are fair with all religions, but in particular, fair with the way Muslims are stereotyped. And we talked a little bit about the hijab and about the dress. What are the other concerns that you would like to address? What is it your goal is in all of what you're doing?
The wife beating, that is a major issue. A lot of people ask me, is it true men can beat their wives and that men are allowed to beat their wives? And the other one is polygamy. And I feel like a lot of Muslim men convert to Islam just because they can have multiple wives. So.
Yes, that's an issue. Can you explain the context of that? The Quran says that a man can have up to four wives. What is the context?
Yes.
What is that all about?
That's under certain conditions, like if she has nobody to support her, then you can marry her. But even then, if the guy is married before, he can get permission from his previous wife to marry any other wives. And like in nowadays, not many women would agree to that unless, you know, she has no source of support. She's like, you know, totally helpless. But nowadays, women are educated. They're like, they have jobs. So women are helpless. Go to Pakistan or India and in the village. Like, she has no parents. Her parents are deceased. She has no brothers or sisters. So she's like all alone. So those are that's the main condition. Like you're allowed to marry other wives. But men nowadays, they don't see that. They're like, you see, this is what I was talking about in previous interviews. Muslim men decide to pick and suits them, what benefits them. So they say, oh, men are allowed to marry four wives? I can marry four wives. No, you cannot. Read the conditions.
I hear what you're saying. So there is a real historical context there. There's an economic context there. It's not just pick and choose and have as many wives as you want. I hear what you're saying. Now, you said earlier that most of the friends that you have are 99% non-Muslims. Where are other Muslims like you? Do you think they're afraid to speak out, that they feel the same way that you do, but because they're afraid of what may happen to them, they're staying sheltered and silent?
I think so. Because when I spoke to a few Muslims, and I tried to promote the honor diary screening in the Muslim community, that was the worst idea I probably came up with, because they're like, oh my God, you're showing this? This is a bad movie. You're going to get killed. You know, people are going to come after you. So, and I think it's the fear. Same thing with ISIS, the fear. They are using fear to control people. And it's the same thing. Men are using fear to control women. So, I don't know. Whenever I talk about anything to do with women's rights in Islam, or just generally women in Islam, everyone talks about it like it's a taboo subject. Like, oh my God, what are you doing? Like, I'm doing something crazy. And that kind of makes me start to doubt myself. Am I doing something wrong? And then I start reading all the cases again. I'm like, no, I'm not doing anything wrong. These women need someone to speak up for them. Like, I can't change the world, but maybe I can make a ripple in this ocean and hopefully create a ripple effect. Like, I'll tell one person, they can pass it on to someone else. That's how you spread the message of peace.
Exactly, exactly. I've said this many times, and you've been a guest on here. I sense such a passion and a courage in your heart. I so applaud what you do. I so support what you do. There should be many other Muslims that are doing what you're doing and not be afraid of the consequences. If Islam has nothing to hide, what is wrong? Why are they so afraid? Why do they crawl into silence? They have nothing to hide. If this is not true of Islam, they have every right to speak up and say, no, this is not how Muslims treat other people. This is untrue. But there's so much fear. And fear is the key, Saba. This is what they use to control women. And a perfect example is the lady in Iran who is sentenced to be executed on Wednesday. And her testimony was not received in court. There are many particulars to this case that was thrown out. And I have to say, my feelings for Rahana is that because she's a woman in an Islamic society in Iran, this particular society in Iran was very oppressive to women. And so I don't believe they took her testimony seriously. And so, again, fear, manipulation of women. I hear what you're saying. You feel like you get tired and you have mixed emotions. Am I not doing the right thing? But you continue to do what you do. What is it within you that gives you courage and gives you strength to keep doing what you're doing?
I just see all these women without a voice, women who have become victims to this fear. And I'm like, okay, I don't know, I can't change the world, but at least I can stop at least maybe one other girl from becoming a victim like this. So, I don't know, I just pray that maybe I can save someone one day.
Well, like, I think that you are...
Yeah, I have a younger sister.
Go ahead.
And I'm just like always telling her that never let anybody control you. Like my family is always like, you have to be a doctor. You have to be a doctor because that's like the standard. Pakistanis can either be a doctor or engineer. Women are usually doctors. And I just keep telling her, no, just do what you want. You're in America. No one can tell you what to do. And I kind of get criticized for that, like you're making her too Americanized, you know, women have no choice, they have to do what pleases the family. I'm like, no, this is her life, let her live it the way she wants.
Absolutely. So I wanted to touch on what you're saying there, excuse me, I wanted to touch on this thing of honor, this definition of honor. What is the real definition of honor? Isn't honor really the way we treat women? We honor them, we support them, we give them the right to choose. This is really true honor, but this kind of honor we're talking about in these Middle Eastern countries and sometimes here is a different term. It's a different meaning to what honor is. Can you explain that?
It's kind of a difficult thing to explain because it's totally different to the Western definition of honor. Basically, I don't know how to explain it, but the honor is always in the daughter and her actions. And anything she does that doesn't please the family, it's kind of bringing shame to the family. So I would say honor is like the actions and the behavior of the daughter. Like I'm the eldest daughter in my family, and it's like all eyes on me. Everything is on me. Like I actually wanted to be a journalist or a lawyer so I could actually do this woman's rights work on a broader scale. But I was told, no, being a journalist is going to bring shame on the family because it's not well paid. I'm like, I don't care about the money. I care about saving lives and getting the word out there. So, I don't know. Now I'm working on a book and they're saying that that's bringing shame on the family, that what will people say that if they find out that, you know, Saba is an author. I'm like, I'm writing the true story of my friend's brother. So it's not bringing shame. I'm trying to, you know, tell people what's happening.
Yes, I applaud you for that. You just keep doing what you're doing because Malala, the Pakistani girl that was shot by the Taliban, has written out two books and talking about education for women and rights for women. And you do the same, Saba. You stand up like Malala, and you're not bringing shame. You're bringing real honor. You're bringing freedom to women. I wanted to ask you, basically, we've talked about this before. Tell us a little bit about, since we've talked about honor and family, how does your family, your mom and dad, feel about what you're doing?
That's a very touchy subject. My dad doesn't know what I'm doing. My mom and my brother, they know, but they're kind of very wary about what I do. Like, I have to hide everything from my brother. He's younger than me, but because he's a boy, he's treated as superior to me. So I have to hide everything from him because he kind of has control over my actions. He has to control my behavior. And it's always like he's spying on me. Like the honor diary screening, it was very difficult to put the posters up and make sure he doesn't find out because he goes to the same college. And my mom, she just thinks I'm going to get killed. And she keeps, she just keeps discouraging me. She's like, nobody cares. Nobody wants to know this. you know, and you're going to get yourself killed. You're not helping anyone. You're harming yourself. So I have to hear this from home, and then I get death threats from outsiders. So it's very, very difficult. And then I don't know if it's sinking into depression, but I get very sad and very lonely, and it's just like, I just cry because I don't know what to do. Should I continue or should I listen to what people are saying?
Well, Saba, first of all, friends that listen to this program will support you and pray for you and do everything they can to help you in your commitment to bring freedom to women. I can guarantee you that the people that listen to this program appreciate you. They applaud you because there are so few of you out there, but you're not afraid. And you know, it's very risky. You're absolutely right. But I want to just remind you that the Christians that listen to this program, the many people that follow this program, are going to support you in every way they can in praying for you. And they're going to follow what you're doing and get the message out because you're not alone. There are many, many others out there that have not been able to speak up because they're afraid. And maybe because you're on this program, those that have been sitting in silence are going to say, I had enough. I got to support my sister. I need to get out there and join her in the fight. So I think many, many good things are going to happen with you coming on this program. It's very, very risky, but the good things, God is going to bless you for your efforts, for your courage.
Because right now, like, I'm kind of seen as the one bringing shame to my family because of what I do. I'm bringing shame to my community because as a Muslim woman, I'm not supposed to speak up, but I'm very opinionated, and if I see injustice being done, I talk about it and I promote awareness and I get the message out there, and they don't like that. They're like, oh no, you're bringing attention to us. And, you know, people are going to hate us. And I'm like, okay, if you're not doing anything wrong, people have no reason to hate you.
Right,
so,
right.
And it's just a lot of mixed things happening. So.
Yes. Yes, I want to just help you here in the time we have left. I want to tell you a promise from the Bible, from the book of Proverbs, that supports what you're doing, that says what you're doing is right. You may think, well, this is what shames my family, but let me tell you, here's what the Bible says to you today, Saba. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Ensure justice for those being crushed. Yes, speak up for the poor and helpless and see that they get justice. This is what the Bible says. It supports exactly what you're doing. You're doing the right thing. And let me just tell you from a Christian perspective, you're being not only courageous, you're bringing great honor to our God. Our great God is honored by what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like this, coming from a Muslim, if another Muslim hears me, this sounds really bad, but I actually turn to the Bible for comfort because, like I said, I've been to a Church of England school, so I don't differentiate between Islam and Christianity because it's still going to the same God, just different paths, but going to the same God. And I don't know, like, I believe that humanity is the greatest religion. Religion and culture come second, but humanity comes first.
I'm glad to hear you say that. When you have picked up the Bible, Saba, and you've read, have you read the Gospels and seen how Jesus treated women, how he showed compassion and respect
yeah.
for women?
And that is really similar to how our Prophet treated women, but Muslims don't see that. I don't know why they don't see that. They say they follow the Prophet, but they are doing the total opposite of what our Prophet did.
Well, I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to a very courageous lady today on the cross in the desert. Her name is Saba, and she doesn't want to reveal her last name, and she's under a lot of pressure and feeling the pressures of what she's doing. I just ask you, as my listeners, to lift this precious girl up in your prayers who's doing everything she can to educate us about the mistreatment of women in her religion and doing everything she can to deal with the stereotypes. Saba, I appreciate you coming on. I'd love to have you on to continue to let you be a voice on my program and educate and help and reach out with your message to Muslims and how they should really treat women. And I thank you again for being honest with us and for not hiding anything for us. You will always be in our thoughts and prayers, and you can always be a guest on my program.
Okay, thank you.
And that is Saba. She attends a university here. And thank you again. God bless you, Saba, for being a guest today on The Cross in the Desert. I can't say enough good about our guest, who has found a way to get her message out under very risky circumstances. And I offer her my program as a platform to do that, because she's doing so much good in this world of hatred and evil and misinformation. She is a shining light in the darkness. Thank you so much, Saba. Saba mentioned that she even picks up the Bible for comfort at times, and I mentioned about the treatment of women and Jesus. We're going to talk about that, but first I want you to hear this really encouraging song today from Christian Stanfill. It's a song called Always, right here on The Cross in the Desert.
My foes are many, they rise against me, but I will hold my ground. I will not fear the war, I will not fear the storm, my help is on the way, my help is on the way. Always.
beautiful and inspiring song from Christian Stanfill, "Our God Will Always Be Our Refuge. He will always give us his help and his comfort, grace in our time of need." I'm just touching on the interview I had with Saba, and we were talking about how women are treated around the world in Muslim communities, how they are hurt, how they are stoned and even beaten in the name of the religion Islam. And we were talking a little bit about there at the end about how Jesus treated women. And, of course, in Iran, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Saudi Arabia, we hear about women being stoned for adultery. We hear about many, many horrific things that break our heart on the treatment of women. But there's an incident in the Bible I want to talk to you about today, about how Jesus treated a specific woman, the woman caught in adultery. And you've probably heard this story many, many times before in the Gospel of John, but I think it bears repeating right here in light of what we've been talking about. It is a sad situation. In Iran, a few years ago, a woman called Sakina Ashtiani, a 43-year-old Iranian woman, was going to be sentenced to death by stoning, but an international outcry spared her from that horrific act. And just recently, she was exonerated and let go. She was, after this experience, has been given freedom, which we are all thankful to God for. But the vicious act of stoning, Saba had mentioned to me that she has shown the movie The Stoning of Soraya M. And it's just a powerful film, so hard to watch, but it must be watched on this horrific act. But in the Bible, Jesus was confronted with a similar situation. The Pharisees and the scribes had brought to him a woman caught in the act of adultery. I want to read to you from my blog about this story. In the Bible, there is a powerful scene where the religious leaders bring to Jesus a woman caught in the act of adultery. Instead of being zealous to uphold the law of God, they use the woman to try and discredit the ministry of Jesus and expose him as a false prophet. "Teacher," they say, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" The scribes and the Pharisees are convinced they have cornered Jesus, and he has no way out. If Jesus agrees to stone the adulterous woman, then his reputation of being compassionate and a friend of sinners will be called into question. If, however, Jesus says to spare her in the law of Moses and will be exposed as a false prophet. So what does Jesus do? He's being cornered by the religious leaders. In what can be best described as an incredible display of compassion and wisdom, Jesus kneels down and writes in the dust with his finger. Then he gazes intently into their eyes with a masterful answer. "Let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." I can picture the utter shock and conviction on the faces of those religious leaders. They never expected an answer like that. Jesus has pointed his finger at the greater sin in this situation, the hypocrisy of the religious leaders. They weren't interested in upholding the law of God, but rather using the sin of a woman to further their crusade of lies and deceit. The statement of Jesus silenced their accusations. One by one, they dropped their stones and departed. Well, the question, was Jesus being soft on the law of God? Absolutely not. He turns to the woman and asks, "Where are your accusers? Does no one accuse you?" The woman answers meekly, "No, Lord." Jesus looks with compassion in her eyes and says, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." Think about this story. In the Gospel of John, this story beautifully illustrates the grace and the mercy of Jesus and how he treated women. He affirms that she's broken God's law. We all have. Yet, instead of agreeing to the execution, Jesus covers her sin with his mercy and compassion. And this is precisely what Jesus did for you and me at the cross. He willingly took the wrath of God in our place so that we could be spared and forgiven this beautiful story illustrates the mercy of God. We deserved death for our sins. We deserve it. We deserve judgment. But mercy steps in and gives us what we do not deserve, grace, undeserved grace. This is one of my favorite examples, one of how Jesus treats women. I have another one here I want to share with you. This is a story that is going to be in my new book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. My new book is not a novel. It is story after story of my Iranian friends, stories of their struggles, their hopes, their dreams, their fears. Some of the stories are about the events in Iran, and a good portion of the stories are about my friends in Iran, and some of the stories are in their own words. This book is very important to me because it's putting a face on my Iranian friends. It's not just a novel about the happenings in Iran. It is their story, much like Saba, who came on and was a guest on my show. She is sharing her story with you, and it's very intimate and it's very personal. I want you to hear Paymana. She is really a new friend for me. I've only known her a few weeks, but one of the first things she did for me was share her testimony, and I thought it was so good and so important, I'm going to put it in my new book. So I want to share it with you. I'm giving you a little preview of what the new book is about. Listen. 1 year ago, Paymana finally escaped from Iran and traveled to Malaysia, where she became a refugee. Shortly before she arrived, she had a powerful, life-transforming experience. Here is her story in her own words. Quote, "For as long as I can remember, my life has been filled with despair. I was empty inside. I was searching for satisfaction and contentment everywhere that I could. At the age of 10, I had a dream of him. I didn't realize it at the time, but I loved him. There was something deep inside of me attracting me to him. I wanted to know him, but I didn't know who he was or where I could find him. In my dreams, I sensed him calling me, but I didn't know what to say. Yet whenever I was scared or sad, I find myself calling out to him. Many of my friends criticized me by saying, 'Why do you call Jesus Christ? You have your own God. You have your own prophets and imams.' Because of the fear and persecution, I had to read his holy book in secret. My parents supported and encouraged me. My father shared with me everything he knew and had read about Jesus. My mother faithfully prayed for me. I spent a lot of time wrestling with my questions about Islam, but they were never answered. I was never satisfied. I found my heart drawn to him and how he carried his cross and shed his blood for our salvation. Jesus never hurt anyone, and yet he was crucified in the cruelest of ways. He spent his life healing the sick, raising the dead, and then giving his life for our forgiveness. He was the source of love and grace. I will never forget the day Jesus finally opened the door for me and sent me to Malaysia. He blessed me with a family of caring and compassionate Christians. Suddenly, I found myself worshiping God for the first time without fear. Yet in all of my rejoicing, I was still confused. I was taught for years and years that Muslims cannot worship God in any other way. Muslims reject the notion that Jesus is God, saying it's the sin of shirk, and those who participate in this become apostates. In my desperation, I cried out to Jesus, 'Oh Lord, you know that I love you. You know I want to serve you for the rest of my life, but can I still be a Muslim and serve you? Please show me the way. Give me a sign.' Jesus answered me in a dream. I saw a man in white clothes. He asked me the directions to the church. I immediately understood the message. Soon afterwards, I was baptized. I washed my soul in water. Regeneration brought happiness and joy. My friends saw the immediate transformation in me. Almost immediately afterwards, the Lord began to train me. Many bad things began to happen to me, accidents, injuries, disease, failures. I knew that the Lord was molding and shaping me. He was testing my new faith. I remember reading a verse in the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 3, verse 3. God will sit as a refiner and the purifier of silver. What did that mean? I found out that the silver refiner heats the pieces of silver. He turns up the heat until he is able to see his face on that piece of silver. The verse meant to me that God brings hardships into our lives and trains and purifies us until he can see his spirit at work in our hearts. I was amazed at this. I said, "Thank you, Lord. I am ready for more pain. I can tolerate anything if it means that you love me." Now I patiently tolerate pain, and in the midst of it all, I have his joy. Now I write my problems with a pencil and God's greatness with a pen. I know that he will erase all of my problems with erasers made of power, greatness, grace, and blessing. Now I do not tell the Lord that I have great problems. Instead, I tell my problems that I have a great God. I want this miracle to happen to my whole family and friends. My prayer is that all Iranians will have this same wonderful experience of Jesus. Pamina is currently living with a church family of Christians in Malaysia and prays that very soon one day she will live in a free country. What a beautiful testimony. I cannot wait for this to be part of my new book, for many people to be encouraged by Pamina, who spent so much suffering of her childhood in Iran. I have another story I'm putting in the book about her childhood, and this is a beautiful testimony of how she met Jesus in a dream. And this is so characteristic of the many books that I've read and the stories that I've read of Muslims having visitations of Jesus in dreams. It's an amazing story of God's grace. Well, as promised, I want you to hear this very insightful interview from Dr. Ben Witherington on Jesus and women. How does Christianity treat women? We're going to find out right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Part 3 of my interview with Professor Ben Witherington, we talked about women. What has been the impact of Christianity for women? Witherington claims that while there have undoubtedly been episodes of persecution and oppression of women by the church, from its inception, Christianity radically challenged the role and status of females in a positive direction. I want to talk to you about women. Now, we often hear that the church has been an oppressive force for women. That they've gained something like equality despite the church and not because of it. But what was the attitude of early Christianity towards women?
Well, let's even look more recently at the women's suffrage movement. That was mostly led by Christians. It's absolutely untrue to simply caricature Christianity in even recent centuries as oppressive of women. Now, have there been Christians who have oppressed women? Of course. Have there been churches that have oppressed? Of course that's true. But you cannot say that there's something rudimentary or fundamental about Christianity that leads to the oppression of women or that characterizes that whole story even in recent centuries. But if we go back to the first century AD, it's very clear to me that Jesus and Paul and others, the effect of their ministry on women was very liberating. I mean, it appears to me reasonably clear that Jesus is the first person in early Judaism to have female disciples, much less traveling female disciples. I mean, there's something radical going on here. If you look at Luke 8, 1 through 3, Jesus is on the road with the 12, plus Mary Magdalene, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Susanna, and other women whom they are not related to. Now, this is a big no-no. I mean, I can see the headlines in the Galilean Gazette now that says, "Radical rabbi on the road again with men and women he's not related to." Oy vey, news at 11.
Scandalous.
Absolutely scandalous. And you know, if you look at the teaching of Jesus, he taught parables in pairs. He'd teach a parable, for example, the parable of the lost sheep that spoke to a man's profession of being a shepherd. And he would pair that with the parable of the lost coin, which talk about a woman cleaning house, you know. And these are images of God looking for the lost. So we have a male image of God looking for the lost, and you have a female image of God looking for the lost. I mean, this is radical stuff in a highly patriarchal culture. So it's very clear to me that not only in the ministry of Jesus, but also in the ministry of Paul and on into the early years of early Christianity, women sensed something new was going on in the ministry of Jesus and in early Christianity, and they responded and were involved in a whole variety of kinds of ministries as a result.
Is there much of a difference in what Jesus taught about women and what Paul taught?
I don't really think so. I mean, if you go through Paul's letters, we have outstanding examples of women whom he calls, for example, Phoebe, he calls a deacon. In fact, the very first person called a deacon in the whole Bible is a woman named Phoebe. He talks about Andronicus and Junia, a man and woman, a couple, who were noteworthy amongst the apostles. This is Romans 16. So we have a female apostle. You read Acts 18, you've got Priscilla and Aquila proclaiming the word of God more accurately to Apollos. I mean, we could just sort of go down the line. We got women teachers, women healers, we got women deacons, we got women patronesses, we got women apostles. So no, I don't think so. Well, then what's those passages in 1 Corinthians 14 or 1 Timothy 2 about? Paul is correcting problems. Problems need to be corrected. If the source of the problem is some women, they need to be corrected. If the source of the problem is some men, I mean, Paul's an equal opportunity critiquer of bad behavior. And so what you should not do with those kinds of passages is sort of think, well, these give us a justification for suppressing the women in ministry. Well, they don't. And Paul would have been the first to object to that.
Rodney Stark has argued that one of the reasons Christianity grew so quickly in those early centuries was that it was so appealing to women. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the reasons for the Roman caricature that Christianity is a religion of women, slaves, and minors is that children and women and slaves saw an opportunity for more equality and more freedom and more redemption than they were going to get in some other kind of context, and they went for it.
What does the New Testament have to say to men about women?
Among the obvious things would be that you're called to respect women as your equals. Men and women are equally created in the image of God, and they're equally redeemed in the image of Christ. And as Paul says in Galatians 3:28, in Christ there's neither Jew nor Gentile, no slave or free, and no male and female, using the terms specifically that refer to gender. In Christ there is no male and female. So what does that really mean? Do men cease to be men and women cease to be women? No, but what it means is that ethnic identity, social status, and gender have no cash value in the order of salvation. They don't make you a more spiritual person. They don't make you a better leader. They don't get you any closer to eternal salvation. Salvation in Christ transcends those categories and transforms and transfixes those categories. So, I mean, it's a pretty radical teaching. Some have called Galatians 3:28 the Magna Carta of human freedom. Of human freedom, in a fallen world full of stratification and hierarchies of all kinds, not just gender hierarchies, but all kinds of hierarchies. Paul is saying, if anyone is in Christ, they are a whole new creature, and the old has passed away. This is pretty radical stuff.
So what do you say to the skeptic who believes that Christianity is chauvinistic, anti-feminist, and harmful to women?
Well, I'd tell them right away they need to read my doctoral dissertation on women in the ministry of Jesus and women in the earliest churches and women in the genesis of Christianity. And of course they won't do that, but then what I would do is just sit down and have a good long chat with them about it and say, look, here's the evidence. You shouldn't give way to caricatures. Of course, it's true. Women and people of color and Aboriginal people have been hard done by some Christians and by some churches. Of course, this is true. But here's my basic dictum I'd say in response to that. Abusus non tollit usum, It means the abuse of something does not rule out its proper use. Christianity at its essence, at its best, is not suppressive of women. It's not abusive of people of color or anything like that. And to say it is in fact to reflect your own ignorance about the essence of Christianity.
And there you have it, Dr. Ben Witherington. I really think he does a great job of going through the scriptures and showing the liberation that Christianity indeed gives to women. I realize there are issues. Today we could talk about women pastors, women in ministries. We'll have to leave that for another time. But I just want to end today reemphasizing the dramatic love and compassion of Christ to women. I really appreciate Saba being honest with us about her feelings, talking about that most of the friends she has is non-Muslims, most of them must be Christians, and how that she is trying to be objective and look at things from that standpoint and be a voice for women, even though she's being criticized. And I'm very thankful for the many people that come into my chat room and comment and leave their messages for me. Thank you, Vito. Thank you for the program. I want to end by saying, please come to my Facebook page, and you will see the petition down the page. You may have to scroll down a little bit. You'll see the petition for Ahana Jabari. I am hoping and praying that this Thursday I do not have to do a radio program about the death of Rahana. Everything within me fights that possibility and reality. That is not something I want to do. I don't want to write my next blog about the death of Rahana. Twice her execution has been postponed. I believe very strongly in the power of speaking out and signing petitions and pressuring, and I believe in the power of prayer. And I'm asking you, as those that follow this program, those that come to my Facebook page, please do not give up. We have less than 48 hours to stand up and to be a voice for Rahana and to say to the Islamic regime, enough, let this woman go. We can do this together. We can be a force of righteousness, a force of good. Together we are very powerful by the grace of God and by the power of His Spirit. And so let's gather together and sign the petition and be a voice for Rahana. I'm going to see you very shortly this Thursday on the next Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible week. God bless you. I will see you again on Thursday.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming.